I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. We're here to get smarter, faster, together, every day with original, memorable insights. That's our OMI from new books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hi, I'm Samantha Cristoforetti, author of Diary of an Apprentice Astronaut, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
The Italian pilot who became an astronaut, who dreamed of living in the sky and one day looking down on planet Earth.
I had an immediate visual perception of that. I mean, I kept flying over this very wide territories on Earth where you can really read the geology, you can see the scars.
In the Diary of an Apprentice Astronaut, Samantha Cristoforetti charts an intense five-year journey of spinning upside down and floating underwater to prepare for the launch of Soyuz TMA-15M, the rocket which takes her up, up and away to the International Space Station orbiting the Earth, where she lives with two crew members for a record-breaking 199 days and 16 hours. Samantha, welcome to Planet Bookomi.
Thank you. Hello, I'm very happy to be here.
You were selected from several thousand applicants. So in the film of your book, this would be a montage, that process, and a speeded up series of tests as you overcome each obstacle. But for you personally, it was a really long, drawn out process, wasn't it? And then when you finally got selected by the European Space Agency, it was like, as you describe it, the universe smiled on you. Did you always think you'd make it through? Are you a very confident person?
Well, I always thought that I had my chances. You know, it wasn't like I applied just to see how it is. You know, so some people that I met through the process, they didn't really think that they qualified, but they applied just in case. You know, why not? You give it a shot. And in my case, I mean, I had been thinking and dreaming about becoming an astronaut for a long time, and I had tried to assemble all the bits and pieces that make you a valid candidate over the years and actually the decades. So I was confident that I had, you know, my chances, that it wasn't completely impossible to be selected as an astronaut. But of course, at the same time, I was very cognizant of the fact that, you know, I wasn't the only one who had been dreaming for a long time about becoming an astronaut and had carefully, you know, crafted their life path with that in mind. And so, you know, I was meeting all the time very, very strong, valid candidates, and I knew it was very competitive. That said, of course, when you get towards the end, you know, and it's not 8,000 people anymore, it's just, well, at the very end, it was really only the 10 of us. You really have this feeling that you can, you know, reach out your hand and touch your dream, that it, you know, it's really taking on substance. It's not just this, you know, fancy or imagination anymore. And at that point, I was extremely emotionally involved, extremely invested in the whole process. And I think it would have been crushing at that point had I not been selected. So as you mentioned, when finally the news came, it was like I had all this instant release of all the tension that had accumulated throughout this whole process that had taken an entire year. And I had really the feeling, oh my gosh, this is one of those moments when the entire universe stops and just smiles at you somehow.
And you train at Star City at the Yuri Gagarin Training Center, don't you? You make it there. And it's in Russia. And the space station is a multinational project run by five different space agencies from Japan, USA, Russia, Canada, and Europe. Is there any rivalry between cosmonauts, or do you all get on? Are they open with you in Russia about their new technologies, for instance?
So at our level of cosmonauts, it's all about being on the same team. I mean, nobody will ever like withhold information from you or anything like that. I mean, that would be a bit absurd because, of course, you're all flying in the same vehicle and you want everyone in that vehicle to be well-trained and well-prepared. That said, you know, at a more, I guess, you want to call it higher or a different level, maybe of engineering exchanges, I'm sure that there are some things that people prefer not to share or not fully share. But everything which is, I would call it operationally relevant, that is important to know in order to run operations, being from the side of the control centers, or of course from the side of crew members, you know, actually being up there in the space vehicle, nothing is withheld. You know, you really need all the information that that is relevant for operations.
And how did you feel when you looked out of your rocket window as you were going up for the first time and you saw your first dawn, your first space dawn in space? With all the system checking, did you get time to enjoy it? You needed the loo at the time, didn't you? Did that put you off?
Well, the loo situation kind of developed over the hours, but that first dawn, I caught a glimpse of it fairly early in the flight. So we took off in the middle of the night. So, you know, the first time that I looked out of the window, it was completely dark. And then we got into orbit, and of course we're flying east, so we're flying towards dawn. And I'm all caught up in doing all the systems checks. I was the flight engineer, so I was mainly responsible to make sure after insertion into orbit that our capsule was working fine, that we were not leaking air into space. You know, that's the most important thing that you want to be sure of once you're up there. And then all of a sudden, my American crewmate, Terry, was like, "Hey, look outside." And so I took a moment to steal this glance outside, and that was basically my first dawn. I didn't quite catch at the moment the actual sunrise, but it was the moment just after sunrise where, you know, you only have this small slice of Earth which is illuminated. And then you see the Terminator, which is this line separating light from darkness on the surface of the Earth. And, you know, you see it coming towards you. You are actually going towards it. But, you know, you see it from your perspective. It's like, you know, it's like it's rolling towards you and it's pushing the darkness away. And all of a sudden, you've got this bright blue planet beneath you.
And on to some practical points now that I'm sure everybody wants to know about, apart from the loo situation, the toilet situation, which I assume once you get to the space station, they've got, like, you know, plain toilets there. So it's quite normal.
Not exactly plain toilets.
What are they like? Are they smaller than aeroplane toilets?
Well, it's not so much about the size, but the functioning, of course, is different, right? You are weightless in space, so everything is weightless, including the products that your body produces when you go to the toilet. And so there needs to be a system and technology to make sure that everything goes in the right direction and nothing gets lost. If you do lose that kind of stuff in the cabin, you're not going to make any friends with your crewmates for sure.
No, I would imagine that would make you very unpopular. And I suppose leaving the seat down is not a problem because of zero gravity, but everything else becomes a problem floating away. On another practical note, what is the optimum hairstyle for living in a space station? And do you bother cleaning it or cutting it? How do you get on with each other living in such close proximity? Do your habits get on each other's nerves, or do you learn to, you know, absorb and adapt?
I don't have any memory of anyone's habits getting on anybody's nerves. I mean, I suppose it would be in principle possible if somebody had some kind of annoying habit, but it didn't happen to us. And if it had happened, I think you would have to carefully broach the subject just to make sure that, you know, nobody's holding a grouch or any irritation is accumulating. But again, it didn't happen in my crew. And in terms of hairstyle, well, most of the guys will have, you know, typical male haircut, you know, rather short, and they, you know, they would just cut it periodically. Although there is some there are some people who have their quirks. So, like, for example, Gennady Padalka, who is probably, I'm pretty sure he's still the person who has spent the most time in space. He's flown like 5 missions, has, I think, over 1,000 days in space. He has this quirk where he doesn't cut his hair at all in space. So if he's up there for 6 months, 7 months, the hair just keeps growing. So you can kind of time, you know, where he is in his mission just by looking at the pictures and his hair length. And in terms of ladies, I mean, I have a pretty short haircut, so I do have to cut it. I think I got 2 haircuts up there by my crewmate, Terry Wirtz, and I got him trained for that. You know, before we left Houston the last time, I actually got our training scheduler to put a class on his schedule with my hairdresser. So I dragged him to my hairdresser, and he got to cut my hair under her guidance. The funny thing is that, again, I have a very simple, short haircut. So it usually takes maybe 20, 25 minutes to cut my hair by a professional. And Terry took 2.5 hours. He's very careful.
Well, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And I suppose he's always got a career in hairdressing now after...
Yeah, I mean, definitely. She said he's a natural. So
yeah, I wonder what that salon would be called if he opened it. Sort of.
Oh, we got something like Chéterie.
Chéterie.
A bit French sounding, yeah.
Yeah, Savoir hair. Anyway. You've got some beautiful quotes in the book that sort of head up each chapter, and you quote Joseph Campbell on his reflections on the art of living, saying the goal of life is to make your heartbeat match the beat of the universe. And it's 5 years since you landed safely from your expedition. I know you've done underwater missions since then, you've been busy, but what does a cosmonaut do for kicks once they've had the adrenaline rush of launching in a rocket? Have you been reborn as an earthling? Do you get bored easier now?
No, at all. I'm somebody who doesn't get bored at all. I mean, if you just give me an interesting book to read, and I'll be happy. So I'm not somebody who needs an adrenaline kick all the time. I did not fly to space for the adrenaline kick. I would never go bungee jumping or anything like that. I guess you get a lot of adrenaline from that, but it wouldn't interest me at all. You know, for me, it's a journey. It's about being part of a community, have a difficult goal to achieve, something that you get, you know, skills that you have to build upon over the years. I mean, I'm more somebody who enjoys, I enjoy immensely the challenge of learning, and learning to fly into space is something that I found incredibly interesting just because it was so varied, right? It has a physical aspect to it, but also the psychological, but also the intellectual, but also the social, you know, the interpersonal relationships, the operational, the scientific. So that's what I really enjoy. I'm in there more for the learning and the journey than for the adrenaline.
Well, we talked this week to Leonard Mlodinow, who co-wrote the Grand Design with Stephen Hawking. And we were talking also to an astrophysicist, and it crops up a lot, the whole notion, especially where we are now in space and time, the notion of meaning and looking for meaning on the Earth. Do you get a different sense of meaning when you are orbiting the Earth?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I mean, I don't think I got a different sense of meaning in a very direct or obvious way. I think it's more, you know, it's an enriching experience. It's very intense. There's a lot of that happens to you, and in terms of things that you are soaking in emotionally, physically, but also in terms of things that you do, that you're responsible for, you know, the human relations that you build. I guess compared to most of the rest of your life, it's a very, very intense, condensed experience. And that, of course, inevitably has an influence in your, you know, it's part of your growth as a human being, and certainly has an influence in your sensitivity. But I think it's more subtle than saying, oh, all of a sudden I was in space, I had this insight, and now I know a new meaning of life. I mean, it's more subtle than that, I think, and a little bit more difficult to grasp and put into words.
Especially when you took so long to train to be there. It's not like you suddenly have a revelation.
Right.
But you say it's really interesting in the book. You talk about how you took a piece of stromatolite. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Stromatolite, a piece of rock with you that's billions of years old. Being up there and holding that rock billions of years old, you sort of imagine what would happen, you know, in years to come with if you dropped that or lost it. Because I find it really funny that even in the space station, you can lose things, or you could lose your bits and bobs if you drop them.
It happens all the time.
And you were thinking, if you lost that piece of rock and then they found it years later in the sea after, you know, that it would possibly confuse ancient historians. Like, what was that doing there with that piece of metal? Does the experience of being in space and the scale of looking down on Earth and seeing the stars around you literally changing your perspective, did it make you feel any more religious or spiritual? I mentioned Stephen Hawking then, and we were talking about Grand Design yesterday and the existence of, you know, science and laws and physics and the need for meaning and the need for a God, did it change your view of science? You talk about when it comes down to it, we're all in space. You're not a particularly religious person, are you?
I'm not religious in the sense of, you know, believing in a structured, codified religious tradition or in a personal God. But of course, that doesn't mean that I don't value the spiritual aspects of life, and I do not seek meaning that doesn't necessarily only come from science or relying on technology. But I don't think that it's going to space station that is going to give you those answers. At the same time, yes, it does change some perspectives. I mean, for me, it changed my perspective of time. And again, it's something that we all learn about, right? How small human history is compared to, you know, Earth's history and the history of the universe. But when I was up there, I had an immediate visual perception of that. I mean, I kept flying over this, you know, very wide territories on Earth where you can really read the geology, you can see the scars and the signs, and even as a non-trained geologist like me, but you know, they're so obvious, like impact craters and scars from geological phenomena that happened, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, and all of a sudden this human presence gets really compressed in such a short moment, which meant that all of a sudden I felt really, really close to generations of humans that have lived maybe thousands of years ago, because all of a sudden the thousands of years felt very, very small. And you start counting the generations and it's like, well, it's not that many. So the humans haven't changed that much. And you realize how fast some aspects of our life have changed, especially in the last few centuries due to scientific development and technological development. But human nature has had a very short time to adapt and change. And so it certainly made me think a lot about that dichotomy, about that struggle, you know, between how our life conditions have changed, but our intrinsic nature as humans cannot have changed that much. And so we are probably not as adapted as we used to be. And that's potentially a problem.
Well, you obviously have what Chris Impey, the astronomist, calls the explorer gene, which people have had since people have existed, you know, since our modern mind and has existed. Do you think we'll explore any further than we are now? Or do you think that current economic and political conditions mean that space travel gets put to one side? Or do you think that maybe commercial interests, you know, with the likes of Elon Musk and private ventures, are making space travel more popular space travel more likely in the future?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm pretty sure we will continue to explore. The question is how fast this is going to go, right? I mean, of course, eventually we will go back to the moon. Eventually, we will go to Mars. The moon is quite real. I mean, there's contracts in place for hardware for both the Gateway, the space station that will fly around the Earth, and also from NASA side for landers to put humans back on the surface. Again, the question is it going to be something Apollo-like, where you know you just have these short missions and you show that you can do it, but then it doesn't turn into something sustainable and robust? The hope, the idea, the ambition this time is to make it a more robust endeavor, kind of like, you know, space station. You know, we didn't just have a few expeditions on space station and then come back. I mean, we've shown that we can, with continuity, we can run operations and do scientific research on the space station. In fact, this year we celebrate 20 years. So the hope, of course, is that the next step is to do the same with the cislunar and lunar space, and then eventually be able to make the step towards Mars. But yeah, the big question is how fast this is all going to happen, and of course, the economic aspect and the political aspects are probably more, you know, will have a bigger influence than actual technological aspects. And then in terms of going to Mars, again, that's just probably at least an order of magnitude more more expensive. So yeah, I mean, it's a question of dry political will. Certainly, it's very interesting to have a lot of private actors getting involved. I don't know that they would be able to stem the cost and the technological effort on their own of a mission to Mars. I don't know if that's really credible. I think one should at least look at it with some healthy measure of skepticism. But at the same time, they contribute, right? They contribute new technologies, new ways of manufacturing, of doing operations that drives down the cost. And so overall, it's incredibly beneficial.
And you are a trailblazer for women in space. Do you think more women are coming forward and seeing your profession as an option these days?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm a trailblazer because I think women had done everything that I have done way before my time. So, you know, women from a previous generation. So I think I should recognize them as the trailblazers and certainly not myself. At the same time, I recognize that in Europe, there's very few astronauts and certainly very few female astronauts. And so for especially European young boys and girls, they might not be familiar with the previous generation. And so it might certainly have an impact to be able to see that it's possible, I think. So we are going to select new astronauts probably next year, start a new selection that will be the first since the one I participated in. And I do expect that there will be more qualified women participating than it was the case like 10 years ago. So we'll see. So that's my prediction.
And what next for you? Do you get to go on more expeditions?
Yes, definitely. I hope so. So from my class, the 2009 class of ESA, two of us already had their second mission. And the idea is, of course, for all of us, one after the other, to get a second stay on the ISS. So my hope, if things work out the way they should, is that I should be able to go back in a couple of years. So let's see. Fingers crossed.
Well, all our fingers are crossed for you, Samantha. Thank you so much for sharing your OMI with Bokomi today.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest. I really appreciate it.
Samantha's book, Diary of an Apprentice Astronaut, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bokomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bokomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify and Google audio platforms. And you can leave a review as well if you like, don't be shy. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, wear a mask. And as Rolls Royce once said, I'm wishing on a star to follow where you are. I'm wishing on a dream to follow what it means. Bye for now.